This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. What does it mean to occupy Wall Street? After all, the protesters in New York City are camped not on Wall Street itself, but in a small park one block away. They want to draw attention to what they see as abuses by the nation's financial system. And Wall Street remains the symbolic center of that system. But as NPR's Jim Zaroli reports, most of the industry's biggest players decamped long ago for other locations.
People who come to Wall Street for the first time are often surprised by how small it is, just a few blocks long. And yet, for much of its history, this little street was the epicenter of the U.S. financial system. Richard Silla is chairman of the Museum of American Finance.
Wall Street just got to be the place where you went to do your banking, where you went to buy and sell your stocks and bonds. The House of Morgan was here, National City Bank was here, the First National Bank was here.
One brisk afternoon recently, Silla and I went for a stroll down Wall Street. The sun had fallen behind the high buildings and the narrow street was already in shadow. Because of the demonstrators, metal barricades have been placed across Wall Street and the sidewalks are choked with pedestrians. Most of them appear to be tourists. Silla says in recent decades there has been a huge exodus away from Wall Street.
So how many big firms are on Wall Street today?
Far fewer than in the past, because most of the big banks like Citi, Chase, and so on, they've moved uptown.
Right now there's just one major bank still on Wall Street, Bank of New York Mellon, though Goldman Sachs isn't too far away. Many of the grand old buildings that once housed Wall Street firms have been converted into condos. What's happened on Wall Street has everything to do with technology, says Charles Jones, professor of finance and economics at Columbia Business School. Back before the telephone, people who traded stocks needed to be near each other.
And everything had to be done by courier or by messenger, by having a runner go from one place to another. So you needed to be really have that physical proximity.
But with computers, Jones says, the decentralization of Wall Street has really accelerated. At one time, for instance, stocks were traded mostly through the New York Stock Exchange at its iconic columned building at the corner of Broad and Wall. Today, Jones says, you can buy and sell stocks from anywhere in the world. Most stock trading now takes place on electronic exchanges, on computers that can be located anywhere. Even the New York Stock Exchange does most of its trading electronically.
That's still where the trading floor is, but the trading floor is basically a showpiece these days. The vast majority of the trading is happening on a computer somewhere in suburban New Jersey.
So Wall Street itself is no longer the physical center of the American financial markets and hasn't been for some time. Richard Silla.
One of the reasons there hasn't been more of a, what you might call a Wall Street backlash or reaction to occupy Wall Street, is that so much of Wall Street is someplace else and is not being very inconvenienced by the occupiers who march around and beat on their drums and so on.
I went over to Zuccotti Park, where the demonstrators are camped out, and I spoke to Mark Bray, part of the ad hoc press team that answers media questions. I asked Bray, why demonstrate here? Wouldn't it be better to go up to Midtown, where the really big firms are located? Bray said the point of the protests isn't to send a message to CEOs.
We're not expecting that they're going to change what they're doing because they hear our protest. Instead, we're trying to appeal to the wider public to re-envision our relationship to democracy and really re-envision how we need to rethink the priorities of this economy.
Bray says Wall Street remains a symbol of high finance. The protests are a reminder of how potent that symbolism remains, even if much of the financial industry has moved away. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Now a fishtail, a case of mistaken identity. Many cases, in fact. A 5-month investigation by the Boston Globe shows that restaurants in Massachusetts are routinely mislabeling fish, often substituting cheaper, lower-quality fish for what's promised on the menu. And many consumers are being told fish is local and fresh when it's actually been frozen and shipped across the country. Boston Globe reporter Jen Abelson co-wrote this story. Jen, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And you ended up having DNA barcode testing done on these fish samples you gathered at restaurants all across Massachusetts. Tell us how this worked.
Another reporter and I, Beth Daly, went about collecting fish from across the state. We mostly focused on species of fish that had been identified by regulators as having been more likely to be substituted than others. These included red snapper, white tuna, local cod, and haddock. And we went to 134 restaurants, supermarkets, and fish markets all across the state and got samples.
And the DNA testing that you had done up in a lab showed what percentage of fish that actually was other than what it was advertised as?
48% came out to be mislabeled.
48%?
48%, yes.
And the numbers were way higher for red snapper. You mentioned that that was a problem fish, and it turned out it was a big problem. Hardly any red snapper was actually red snapper.
Yeah, we tested 26 samples of red snapper, and 24 times we got served something else. We were served ocean perch, crimson snapper, Colorado snapper, and tilapia.
What would the price differential be between the fish that's actually served and what was being promised, the red snapper?
So at sushi restaurants, which routinely substituted tilapia, that costs about $2.30 a pound, whereas red snapper could cost about $5.20 a pound.
It's interesting because you point out that what's going on isn't just deceptive, but there can be real health implications, too, with some of the fish that's being substituted.
Definitely. We found escalar, which is nicknamed in the industry the X-lax fish. It was masquerading as white tuna, which many people would assume would be albacore. And the X-lax fish has an oily content that can cause some severe gastrointestinal issues.
Mm. Well, what did restaurant owners say when you told them about what you'd found?
We got a mix of responses. There were some that were genuinely surprised and blamed the mislabeling on suppliers who had duped them. Others found that it wasn't a big deal, that everyone in the industry does this, and so the FDA is trying to do more. In 2009, the Government Accountability Office issued a report that said that they were not doing enough to combat seafood fraud and mislabeling in particular. So much of the seafood these days is imported. 86% of all the seafood that Americans consume is imported, and the FDA inspects less than about 2% of it. And so they're starting to try to pilot some DNA testing, but it's still in the early stages.
Well, Jen, what do you think the lesson is for consumers? If you want to have some clarity that what you think you're eating is actually the fish that you think it is, what do you do?
I think consumers have to ask a lot of questions the way we asked a lot of questions of the chefs, of the restaurant owners about where they're getting their fish. You know, the takeaway is that if you're at a sushi restaurant and they're serving red snapper, it's almost definitely not red snapper. It's probably tilapia. And if you're ordering white tuna, it's also probably not white tuna. You're probably going to get escalar.
It is pretty striking when you think about it that you're talking about restaurants in Massachusetts, which has such a long-standing and at least at one point thriving fishing industry.
We were fairly surprised at how widespread this was, given that Boston is such a seafood-savvy town. And it came to us as a bit of a surprise that the scope, it hit restaurants, low-end, high-end, chain, mom-and-pops, and no one seemed to be immune.
I've been talking with Jen Abelson of the Boston Globe. Their series is called Fishy Business. Jen, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Now we open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine. That's something we do just about every week for interesting stories about the way we live now. Today, the story of a Washington power player. Now, everybody knows that Washington is a place where people understand how to get and use power. And people understand the kind of power that comes with having a seat in Congress or having an office close to the West Wing. But now we want to tell you about another kind of power, one that comes from giving. She's known for the checks she writes to various causes. Since 2008, philanthropist Adrienne Arsht has donated some $56 million to nonprofit organizations from Miami to Manhattan, and that has made her a force to be reckoned with. She's the subject of a profile in this week's Washington Post magazine, and she's with us now. Adrienne Arsht, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Now, you grew up kind of well off, as the article describes. I mean, by the time they died, your parents, who were both professionals, were in a position to donate several millions of dollars to causes they believed in, education and medical issues and so forth. I was just wondering what message you grew up with around giving.
Well, I don't think that I grew up in a sense of great economic situation. But by the time my parents died, they had accumulated funds. But it was not something in my growing up that was relevant. And I think, though, that from the time I was a child, what one did in the community was service. I mean, my mother ended up being the chairman of the Visiting Nurse Association. She was chairman of what was then called the Red Feather, which is what we call the United Way today, or my father on the board of the Child Guidance Center.
I do want to mention that they're both children of immigrants. They both went to law school, worked their way through. Any wealth that they acquired was from earnings, something that they earned throughout the course of their living. Do you have any sense of what motivated them to give?
I'm almost inclined to think of it as sort of a genetic or sort of DNA. I think giving and helping others is the reason you exist, and I'm not sure where that comes from. Some people may consider it religion. Others may just have read and come to that conclusion. I would say that giving is one of the most joyful things you could ever do. So if we are motivated by pleasure, I certainly would say that giving gives you a great deal of pleasure.
Do you have a metric or some particular benchmark that you use when you're trying to decide how or when you want to make a gift?
I think that the point would be a game changer as opposed to a participant in an ongoing campaign. It was something that perhaps would not happen without that gift.
Yeah, the article makes the point that there's some really, really funny comments from you in the article. One of the points that you make is that when powerful men or men of means give, they're called philanthropists. When women give money, they're called socialites. What's up with that?
I'm not sure I said about men give and they're called, but when men attend social functions, they're considered doing it for business reasons. They are there to network. They are there to put the brand of their company out there as having supported something. When I did it in Miami and I had the bank, Total Bank, and it was no different than a bank that was owned by a man, but I was not considered out there doing business. I had a community bank. It was the role of the bank to participate in the community. And wherever I was the business. But people seem to want to think about it as more a plaything than a business.
If you're just joining us, I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm visiting with Adrienne Arsht. She is a Washington, D.C. philanthropist. She's the subject of a cover story in the latest Washington Post magazine. The article makes the point that in part, one of the reasons that you give and give publicly is that you want to set an example so women know it's okay to give. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Women are much more inclined to protect whatever money they have. And that's a good thing to protect for their home and the children. But they're less likely to give it because they have a great fear of being a bag lady. And so what I'm hoping to show is it's okay to give. And yes, I'm still afraid of being a bag lady, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Have you ever made a mistake in giving? Did you ever give to something and say, oh, wow, I really shouldn't have done
that? Oh, sure. But in the end, it's so insignificant. I mean, mistake is just, oh, well, maybe I could have done it a little differently. But the money was not used in a fraudulent or bad way. It just may not have been quite what I thought when I came up with a gift. But there's no bad gift.
Hmm. There are people who belong to religious traditions that suggest that all gifts should be anonymous. But I think that there are other people, even apart from perhaps that religious teaching, who don't want to be seen as showing off. If somebody felt that way, what would you say?
Well, I don't think giving is showing off. I think giving is a core responsibility, and that what you do when you give both sets an example and it defines things that are of value to you. And there's the phrase, put your money where your mouth is. What you believe in, I think, is worth standing for, and it can be 25 cents. When you're somewhere and you want to leave a tip for good service, and you calculate it, and let's say it's 75 cents, and you have a dollar bill, you can leave a dollar. That's a 25-cent gift. It doesn't have to be lots and lots of zeros. It's a thought about aiding something or someone that you believe in, and when you think about pennies thrown into a fountain. I'm on the board of Lincoln Center, and there are three fountains in the entire complex. And people throw in coins, and we collect them every 2 weeks. And thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars are collected for Lincoln Center. One nickel, one penny, one quarter at a time. It makes a difference. And for the person who threw in that one penny, that was generous.
Adrienne Arsht is a philanthropist here in Washington, D.C. She is profiled in the latest Washington Post magazine. The piece is titled Making a Name for Herself. Adrienne Arsht, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now we want to spend some time talking about Haiti, one of those parts of the world that seems to have seen more than its fair share of suffering and seems to have produced more than its fair share of great art. Later in the program, we will meet a choir with roots in the Haitian diaspora that has become one of Cuba's most acclaimed musical groups. They're now on their first extensive U.S. tour, and we will meet them in a few minutes. But first, back to the suffering. You'll remember that devastating earthquake nearly 2 years ago. In the past year, nearly 500,000 Haitians have now gotten cholera, and more than 6,000 of them have died from the disease, which emerged in the aftermath of the earthquake. To this point, the response to the epidemic by the country's leaders has been widely viewed as inadequate. But the new government is making a new effort. Here is Prime Minister Gary Corny, who is also Dr. Corny, a medical doctor.
We'll take the opportunity of the cholera epidemic actually to rebuild our health system and make sure that it's much more effective in providing services to people. I'm very confident that with the support of our key partners, we'll be able to make a significant improvement in that situation.
That was Prime Minister Corny in conversation with Miami Herald reporter Jacqueline Charles. She's been with us many times to talk about Haiti, and she joins us once again to talk more about the current situation. Also with us, Dr. Louise Ivor. She lives in Haiti and works with Partners in Health. She helps manage that organization's medical service team in Haiti, and they're both with us now. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Hello.
Dr. Ivers, I'm going to start with you and ask you to remind us again what cholera is and why it is such a problem in Haiti right now.
Of course, cholera is a bacterial infection. It's transmitted through contaminated water supply. And once the bacteria has been introduced into an environment where water and sanitation are lacking, there's a high risk of transmission from person to person and continued illness of many different communities and many different people. Because the health system in Haiti is so fragile to begin with, long before the earthquake, this was also true. This health system has had a very difficult time initially in responding to the outbreak of cholera, and then that's continued because of the lack of good water and sanitation available for people, which would allow them to prevent themselves from becoming infected with cholera.
Jacqueline, do we know, as you reported, the cholera has not been known in Haiti for the last two decades, and then these reported cases emerged just after the earthquake. And we can understand, you know, how with a lack of a sanitation infrastructure and a lack of sort of consistent health services, how this could spread. But do we know how it started to begin with? Do we have any sense of the origin of it?
Well, there's been a lot of debate and talk about this, especially as it relates to the United Nations troops from Nepal. And this has been a very controversial issue because the UN itself has done a report. And while that report did not directly implicate those individuals, I mean, among a lot of people in Haiti, they believe that cholera has arrived there for the first time in a century because of these troops, because of the sanitation near the base where they are. The water supply became contaminated. But the UN has not said that in their own findings or their own independent studies. But that is the feeling, and that is a very touchy issue in terms of the debate.
And so you recently spoke with Dr. Corny, the new prime minister, as we said. Could you just tell us a little bit more about his plans to curb this?
Well, he did say that he is, you know, willing to use the vaccination that Partners in Health has recently announced. At the same time, he wants to put out young people as community health aid workers and just send them out to these communities, because today reaching these remote villages is so incredibly difficult. Some of them are 2.5-5 hours just walking just to get to them. And so the news, even of what is cholera, many of them don't know because they've been cut off via communication. They don't have cell phone access. And so that remains a great challenge today in Haiti, especially when it rains. That's when we start to see the spike in cholera. So we have to continue to educate Haitians in a public education campaign until we can address the issue of good water and sanitation.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about Haiti's cholera epidemic and new efforts to combat the disease. My guests are Dr. Louise Ivers of Partners in Health and Jacqueline Charles, Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald, who's been reporting on this. And Jacqueline, could you just remind us again of why this vaccination program has been controversial to this point?
Well, initially, the previous government, they were concerned about rolling out a vaccination program when there was such limited supply in the marketplace, 200,000 doses, and we were about to enter into an election. And in Haiti, you know, elections can be chaotic, as we saw with the previous, you know, presidential elections. So they did not want to, you know, stroke social unrest. And so, you know, that was their main issue.
I don't understand. Are you saying that the concern was because there were only 200,000 doses then available, there was a question of, like, how would it be distributed and how could it be seen as fair? Was that the issue?
Exactly. And not having people use this in some sort of political means. And so there was a lot of questions. How do you decide who gets it? Where do you distribute it? And so that was, you know, their issue and their argument for not going that route. At the same time, I have to tell you, since this announcement has been made, there remains concern on the ground in Haiti among medical doctors about this vaccination and about whether this is a route that the country needs to take. So there is still some debate that is going on and discussions, despite the fact that the current administration has reversed the previous administration's decision and they have shown a dramatic policy shift in now going the route of the vaccination.
Who will receive the vaccination? Who is targeted for it? Has that been decided?
Well, I'll answer that. The 200,000 doses of the vaccine that are available is a very simple issue of supply and demand. The vaccine is produced by a commercial company, and as soon as they have a purchase order for larger amounts of the vaccine, they will produce larger amounts of the vaccine. So if, for example, in October of 2010, when the outbreak began, we had ordered cholera vaccine, there would be several million doses of the vaccine available at this stage. So the issue of availability of the vaccine is a little bit of a red herring. It certainly wouldn't be the first time that a program, a public health program, was rolled out as opposed to attempting to vaccinate 5 or 10 million people all in one go. What we're planning to do as we begin the rollout of the available doses is to cover a geographic area in urban Haiti and a geographic area in rural Haiti. Both areas are very poor access to water and sanitation and will provide us with the opportunity to be able to document the logistics and feasibility issues that have raised some concern amongst those who are wary of trying to use this tool in Haiti.
And Jacqueline, could you clarify for us, as I understand it from both of you, that the root of this is sanitation, is access to potable water, drinkable water, and also clean water for purposes of washing and so forth, and whatever the sanitation infrastructure is. I think many people will remember that there was a tremendous effort by the international community to raise money to support Haiti's rebuilding efforts in the wake of the earthquake. It got tremendous attention around the world, particularly in the U.S., where there's a large Haitian community. And I think many people might wonder, were there not sufficient resources to address this problem, since it seems to be an obvious one? So can you just help us understand this?
Well, I have to tell you, when cholera first broke out, I went to an area called Grand Saline. It's an inlet where they had the highest cases because this is where the Artibonite River, which was contaminated, where it went out to sea. And there were 30,000 people who supposedly lived in that community and supposedly only 50 latrines. I still have not seen the first latrine. The people were washing and using the river, you know, as their drinking water. They were using the sea as their bathroom. And so when you talk about an earthquake, a lot of the focus was in the urban areas that were struck by the quake. But when we talk about a country where very few people have access to potable water and to sanitation, you clearly cannot expect that this issue is going to get solved in a matter of 12 months or even 24 months. I mean, this is really an issue about access to water and sanitation, which should be rights, but unfortunately in Haiti, they are luxuries.
And Dr. Arvizo-Ferrit, have a final thought from you.
Long-term investment in public water and sanitation facilities is absolutely critical, not just for cholera, but also for the many other diarrheal diseases that result in a lot of children in Haiti under 5 dying every year. That's really the most important thing. And in the short term, continued support in treating cholera cases, support of this vaccination campaign, as well as investment in the public health system should help in many ways for Haitians to have better health.
Dr. Louise Ivers works for Partners in Health in Haiti. We caught up with her in Ireland, where she's traveling at the moment. Jacqueline Charles is the award-winning Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. She was kind enough to join us from member station WLRN in Miami. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
As President Obama focuses this week on housing and jobs, his potential Republican challengers are keeping up a drumbeat of criticism over his announcement last week that all American troops will be out of Iraq by the end of this year. In debates and on the stump, Republican presidential candidates are attacking each other, but they're also keeping up a steady anti-Obama refrain. For some analysis, we're joined this morning, as we are most weeks, by NPR's Cokie Roberts. Good morning, Cokie.
Hi, Renee.
Now, it would seem to be a positive announcement. All troops home for the holidays from Iraq. Isn't that what Americans want to hear from the president?
Yes, it is. I mean, the most recent polling on it shows that 2/3 of Americans were opposed to the war in Iraq. Now, instructively, that polling was last January. It's just not been at the forefront of American concerns, even though we've lost almost 4,500 troops killed in Iraq. So it is, you know, it's just not been on the front burner. But President Obama made the point that this was a deal that President Bush and the Iraqis had done together. But still and all, his Republican opponents, as you said, went after him over the weekend, trying to convey the idea that he's weak on defense. And that is a label that's hurt Democrats, you know, since Vietnam days. Republicans think they can keep it working for them even though the American people are ready to get the troops home. You know, actually, Renee, both things can be true at the same time. People might want to get the troops home, but might also fear that the Democrats are not strong enough internationally, even as President Obama can say that Osama bin Laden is dead, Gaddafi is dead, and Mubarak is gone.
Well, this whole political attack on the president does raise the question, who is most hurt by this contentious and very long Republican presidential contest? I mean, a battered eventual Republican nominee or President Obama?
Well, that's always an interesting calculation. And I think this year we really have this odd Republican race with people sort of popping up to the top of the polls and then dropping back, all in an effort to find the not Romney candidate. And I think it's something of a cacophony out there in these many, many debates. The one clear message that does come through is the anti-Obama message. And there are lots of students of presidential politics who believe that a long fight in one party, despite the incredible drain on resources, actually works for that party because that party's getting their message out. Candidates are honing their skills. That certainly worked for President Obama when he was running in 2008. But now, of course, he's the recipient, and we see his favorability number in the latest Gallup poll is the lowest ever, and more Americans saying the country is off on the wrong track, which is always a terrible number for incumbents. And I think at least some of those low numbers for the president and the country probably are coming from the relentless attacks by the Republican presidential candidates.
So what does the president do? If getting enemies abroad and bringing troops home are things that may or may not work for him, but are certainly overwhelmed by Americans' concerns for the economy, how does he improve his standing in time for the election?
Well, trips like the one he's taking today to Nevada matter. It's especially important to get the Hispanic vote out, excited about turning out in places like Nevada this week and Colorado next week, and convince them that even though he hasn't done immigration reform, it's still worth showing up to vote for him against the anti-immigration rhetoric of the Republicans. It's a hard sell. On the jobs bill, which the Congress seems not to be passing, he can run against the Republicans for failure to do popular things, but it could backfire.
Koki, thanks very much. NPR's Koki Roberts joining us as she does most Mondays. And you're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.